In the last episode, we considered internships and the transition out of college and into the working world. Today, we turn the dial back to the beginning of the college process and examine specifically the virtual approach to college counseling. I'll be joined by Sawyer Earwood. Sawyer is an education professional who has worked in both college admission offices and small startups. His admission experience has taken him across the USA and Asia. During his tenure as Assistant Director of Enrollment at Hendricks College, he managed the university's enrollment coaching program and recruited domestic and international students alike. Sawyer's prior work experience includes oversight of launch operations at AdmissionsGeek, an ed tech startup, project coordination for Intune Inc., an online music startup, and conducting international marketing in Shanghai at SMH, International Consulting Agency. He graduated from Rhodes College with a BA in International Studies focusing on East Asia. Sawyer, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Certainly. So could you explain a little bit about your background, specifically what got you into college counseling?
Yeah, sure. So like most people, I did not wake up as a five-year-old dreaming of becoming a college counselor or an admissions counselor. I am a first-gen college student, so I was fortunate enough to go to a relatively small school and had a college counselor there that was very generous, took me under her wing and helped me through a lot of the process, and had a loving mother who was phenomenal, but not super deep well of knowledge about college because she had never gone through the process. So I kind of got introduced to it there. And I used to always joke that I remember going to a college fair and kind of poking fun at all of the admission counselors that were like behind these plastic tables and eating like Jimmy John sandwiches and traveling in like rented cars for weeks on end. And fast forward, I graduated college and kind of ended up in a scenario where I didn't have something lined up. And I was looking for jobs and I was like, man, where have I always felt empowered and like doing my best work and full of passion and joy? And it was always in school or in the education system. And so started looking at admissions. And one of the colleges I looked at, it was my second choice actually to attend, Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas. They were hiring an admission counselor. And I was like, well, I mean, if it was good enough for me to consider paying them money every year, then I guess it might be good enough for them to pay me money every year. So hopped in there and thought it would just be a job that tied me over for 1 year or something until I found something better. And 4.5 years later, I really thoroughly enjoyed it. And the main transition from admissions world to college counseling was truthfully the pandemic. I loved a lot of things about my job, and most of it was traveling, meeting students and families. All of that kind of interpersonal connection was really important to me. And pandemic came along, and they were like, well, you're not going to be traveling, no one's going to be visiting, you're not going to be talking to people. And I was like, well, this just doesn't sound that great anymore. So ended up briefly joining an admissions education kind of tech startup, and then ended up finally settling down with my business partner, Jessica Chermak, and we kind of co-founded Virtual College Counselors, which is where I'm at now.
I gotcha. Your career description reminds me of the John Lennon quote, life is what happens when you're trying to do something
else. It's exactly that. And I think that truthfully, when we work with students, Jess has a similar background where kind of like, if you look at your resume, you're like, what in the world? Like, these are all impressive, but none of them are connected. We'll talk with students about that a lot. Right. Where like, you can plan and plan and plan, but sometimes life's going to throw obstacles at you. Doors are going to open or close. And you know, being flexible and adaptable is part of, you know, being a successful person in life. So that's something that we really reiterate to them with our own stories.
Now, what do you think the best part of college counseling is?
So you could ask every different college counselor and they give you a different answer. For me, I've always really found a tremendous amount of maybe catharsis through my own process is helping students kind of begin to unwind some of these ideas that have been embedded in their heads, whether it's by parents or media or rankings or whatever it might be about the college process. And so that can be anything from, you know, redefining a safety school as not the school you have to go to because nothing else worked, but rather a school that is likely to admit you that you'd be excited to go to anyways, things like that, or even just sitting there and kind of saying, okay, well, these are rankings, but how are those rankings made? And, you know, the deeper you dig into, we'll pick on, you know, U.S. News and World Report, the more you begin to realize that a lot of these rankings are not based off of substantial things that are going to directly translate to a student experience. So those kinds of things are fun. I think dismantling acceptance rates is always really enjoyable because students will see an acceptance rate and either think, oh, that's easy, or they'll think it's impossible. And giving them an idea of like what goes into that or how those numbers are so easily manipulated. Yeah, just exactly. Giving them knowledge.
Like the scholarships, early admissions.
Yeah, it's bonkers. Really, and it's so intentionally opaque at a lot of places and intentionally and needlessly bureaucratic that I would argue that at some institutions, it is part of the strategy to make sure that families and students are always just kind of on edge and not super knowledgeable, and they take advantage of that. And that's not every school, but certainly a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. You mean knowledgeable about the college?
Yeah, the ins and outs of anything. I mean, everything from if I apply early decision, what does that mean for applying to other schools? If I get a financial aid award and they lump in the loans to look like scholarships, there's all sorts of weird little nuances that I think one of my biggest ones that's a pet peeve, and most students and families see through it, but you get admitted, everybody's excited. Before you get that full financial aid letter, usually you'll get a scholarship letter. And they always lump all 4 years of scholarships into one big number. And they're like, congratulations, you've been awarded $175,000. And like these kids and families are like, oh my God, we can finally go to college. And like, I'm so excited. And then they're like, just kidding. Actually, we're going to break that up into 4 years and you still owe 40K and like, here's 5K in loans. Good luck.
Wow. I didn't know they did
that. It's a pretty common practice. It happens all the time is they know if they can get this shock and awe with like really big numbers or really flashy acceptances that a lot of times families will just instantaneously buy in at almost like a spiritual level to this future that they see in front of them. Right. And it's not typically what they actually expect.
All right. So switching gears for a second, you have some experience and you sort of mentioned it briefly in your bio there, but what you would call launch operations. Can you describe those experiences and kind of what you learned about the industry?
Yeah. So I was thinking about this recently, actually, and I'm realizing now that a lot of the same tendencies that go into overexcited teenagers going through the college search process can also lump in with a lot of times those launch operations. And I will say that my experiences have been mixed. So, you know, I am by no means a neutral party in that. But what I will say is that the thing that I thoroughly enjoyed about every kind of launch operation, whether that was working for someone else or kind of co-founding this business with my business partner, I think the thing that I always really enjoy is just this unbridled creativity. There's such an energy that goes in that I say this now, and I think, man, I didn't have a good work-life balance. But, you know, at the time I was working at the Admissions Geek launch, I was working like 12 hours a day for 7 days a week. I mean, and that's not an exaggeration to sound impressive. Right. It's not healthy. But I didn't care because I was so energized. I mean, I loved it. And it's the same thing with this company, Virtual College Counselors, is that I love the fact that if there's something wrong or something doesn't feel right or we reach an obstacle, like, you know, Jess and I can sit down and right then and there, no bureaucracy, make a decision. And if we don't like how something looks on the website, we log in and we change it. We don't have to go through somebody else.
Right.
So I think that is always really, really energizing, that creativity, the flexibility, the adaptability of it. I think on the other side of this is I think that a lot of people, they'll see an opportunity and they'll think, oh, well, that's cool. Like, I'll make a website, hire a handful of people, and we'll be generating like 100,000 plus in revenue in the first 2 months. And it doesn't work that way most of the time. And so I think the downside of my experience with launch operations is what tends to happen is you get a people with a tremendous amounts of resources that can just kind of burn those, whether it's a good idea or not. And very rarely do I see kind of a long-term success opportunity for it. Either there's so much gas at the beginning because they want to get straight to that place where they're like, you know, making lots of money and have a great program set up. Or alternatively, there's not enough gas. And then we start to run into the fact of how are you going to pay people? What does this look like long-term? We're just kind of slugging along. And I think that those are kind of the dualities that can be frustrating, is so much energy and creativity, especially if you have a phenomenal team. But then also the idea of, you know, startups aren't necessarily always thinking about how can I be a long-term project.
I see that you do have a role with the IECA. Mm-hmm. Could you explain what it is you do there?
Yeah, IECA, that is kind of one of the governing bodies of independent educational consultants. And so there's typically two. Mm-hmm. One is HECA, H-E-C-A, and the other one's, you know, IECA. Yeah. I chose IECA. Both are fine. Yeah. Doesn't make a difference to me. Mm-hmm. For IECA, I am involved in a couple different ways. I'm on two different committees. So one is our Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee, which I've always had a pretty big passion about, coming from a lower income background as a first gen student. That's always been something that's kind of lingered over me. And then the other one is a global committee. And so that has to do with any students crossing borders. So Americans going abroad for college, international students coming to America, DACA students, undocumented students, whatever that looks like. And so most of the time, the reason I ended up on that board was because when I worked in college admissions, I was in charge of international recruitment. So I have a little bit of experience on that end, studied history and international studies in college. And one day in the past, you know, imagined that I would be traveling abroad for my job, and got a little bit of that. But suppose I still got a lot of life left in me. So we'll see where that goes. But I guess specifically thinking about IECA, really the reason I participate in IECA, and this is a topic that comes up a lot, because I think a lot of professional organizations, one, independent educational consulting is not a young field. Most people have been in a high school for a long time. They've worked in admissions for a long time. I think for quite a while, I was the youngest person in IECA. And so in that sense, it is a lot of kind of older individuals. And one of the things that I think is really frustrating is a lot of times people will come up to me and they'll be like, hey, like, how do we get more young people to join our organization? And I'm like, honestly, I don't really know. They're like, you're younger. Don't you know how everybody thinks?
Pipeline, right?
But they'll ask me, and I'm like, it's kind of hard because, okay, so let's say when we think back to, like, let's just say 1950s, like, meeting once or twice a year at an annual conference is huge because it's harder to stay in contact with people. There's not an internet that's full of resources. Yeah. There's less books on this subject. But nowadays, if I want to reach out to a professional, I can message them on LinkedIn or check out their website. If I want to learn from professionals, there's everybody and their grandma has a webinar or a podcast or a blog that, like, you can kind of find some information from, some better than others. Yeah. And then, you know, books wise, there's so many books now using very solid, rich, recent data about college admissions that those professional organizations don't carry as much maybe value to a younger generation that has kind of grown up learning to outsource all these different pieces and bring them together to kind of create their own profile.
Here are a few things that stuck out to me after the first portion of my conversation with Sawyer. It's interesting to me to hear him talk about his experience with the private industry and really with startups. When you're looking to employ an educational professional like this in a private setting, you're really getting a whole different sort of can of worms versus a more institutional or public setting for college applications. And I think it starts with the profile of the person that you're getting, that you're employing to accomplish that. Really, I would say when you compare private and public institutions, you know, in privacy, you have sort of proliferation of creativity, or it's a very independent venture. You're really out on your own, you know, and as he talked about that, you could hear sort of the excitement about, you know, not having to check off something in, you know, five or six different boxes in an administrative setting. That sort of drags down that whole creative process. And I think that does trickle down into college admissions and turns it into more of a bureaucratic exercise of, you know, assigning a number to a student. So I think that's really one of the big reasons why you would want to seek assistance from that private setting when you're looking at college placement. Another point that I found interesting was about organization and routine being a must in those online settings, and him sort of being honest about his own sort of foibles and his own humanity, I guess,
you know, in sorting through that for a student, finding their best sort of work routine. He called it looking for pockets of progress. I found that to be an interesting phrase, you know, and perhaps that's the best way to do it with a teenager, is rather than be sort of hard-handed about it and pejorative, you coach them through their own experience, really puts them in charge, you know, of something that's really an entry into the adult world to begin with, and a development of autonomy that perhaps doesn't go as well when you turn it into that hard-handed experience. Can you detail the process that you go through with clients? Yeah. When do you kind of typically begin with them? And you know, what type of services?
Right. So I think start with services, because that's an easier one. So typically when we're thinking about the college process, there's a couple different pieces. And for the most part, when students work with us, they work through every piece of the process with us. So that starts with like getting to know the student, learning maybe what they're looking for in a college, learning that they might have no clue what they're looking for in a college, and kind of sussing that information out. They usually will kind of develop into building a college list. Once they have a college list, we'll usually tackle some things that don't require essays first. So taking all those extracurriculars you've done and starting to put them in the proper formats for these applications. Usually work on essays over the summer. And one of the things I say with every student is the word essay and summer should never be in the same sentence for a high school student. But if we can do it strategically, it's going to save you a lot of time and effort senior year, where you can actually focus on having fun and enjoying yourself and your classes. And then really, usually we try and get all of our students to apply early to school. So usually October 15th to November 15th is when we're really pushing with students. They get those in. A lot of times they'll get answers back by December, January, February. They might do a little bit of visits, apply for scholarships. We'll talk about making that final decision. And most students are done making their decisions by May 1st. So it's kind of the zoomed out timeline. The two things we don't do, and we're pretty clear about this. One, we do not do any form of test prep. So ACT, SAT test prep, nothing like that. I hate standardized tests. I hate them when I was a teenager. I don't really philosophically like them now. And if possible, you know, some students get great scores. Awesome. Let's roll with it. Some students don't do great, and that's totally fine. There's a path forward for them too, especially with test optional and everything. The other piece we don't offer is what I would call significant financial advising. If you have questions about financial aid documents, scholarships, totally equipped to talk about all that. When you start saying, you know, how can I hide money so that the college doesn't see how much money I have? That's where I'm like, first of all, I don't think you should do that. But aside from that, you don't want me doing that for you. So that's kind of what we do as far as like what services do we do as students. Now, when do we start working with students? A lot of people, especially parents, will be like, when should we start the college search process? Or they'll be like, is it too early to start the college search process? A resounding, I would say yes. I don't think really students should be thinking about college applications probably until like spring of their sophomore year at the earliest. As far as the first couple years, there's a lot of things you can do to set yourself up for success for the college application process, but there are things that you should be doing to be successful in high school anyways, like getting good grades, being engaged. Like there's this phrase, and we've all heard it. We've all done it probably in our own lives, but it looks good for college. We hear that all the time. Right. And one of the things that I really try and dispel with a lot of students and families is what looks good to a college is being engaged in things you actually care about and being like excited to do it. Like we're not asking you to solve, you know, some fundamentally unresolved math problem. We're not asking you to cure cancer or save the penguins. Like these are all monumental tasks that no student should be ever expected to do. I'm just asking you to do something with your time. That's all. I think that college has become sensationalized, and we see it every year. You know, students that got into all the Ivy Leagues, or a student that wrote an essay that just said no, period, and got into their college. Like all these crazy stories, or, you know, we used to have parents every now and then, especially in Arkansas, because it is predominantly a red state and higher ed is not always well received there. But they parents would come in, they'd be like, well, I don't see why my student needs to go to college. And I'd be like, well, like, here's some reasons that you might want to consider. And they're like, yeah, but like, you know, like Einstein dropped out of college and like, you know, Bill Gates didn't like, and you know, all, they start naming all the Mark Zuckerberg. And I'm like, yeah, but like, let's put the earmuffs over your child real quick. And let's actually, do you think that your student is the next Einstein? Because I'm looking at their transcript and it's a little iffy. They seem like a lovely student and they'll be engaged. They'll find their people. They'll do cool stuff, but it's not going to be starting a multi-billion-dollar social media company. The toughest part for me is just watching its effects on teenagers. And we talk a lot about like this at a larger scale. Like, you know, I think if you rewind the clock, you have like, what is violence on TV doing to young kids? And then it's like, okay, well, video games doing to young kids. And it's like, what is social media doing to young kids? And there's a lot of things to certainly have merit about that. But I think the same could be said about like how the media tackles the college process is these students see, you know, students that have a 4.7 on a 4.0 scale, and they're president and valedictorian, and they're starting a nonprofit, which they'll promptly abandon once they get into college. There's so much stuff that goes into, like, they only see these exceptional cases, and they don't see that student that has a 3.3 and is just kind of making their way, and they think, man, I tried, but even trying, and there's no future for me. I'm like, no, man, there's tons of schools that would love to have you, and you'll get a great education there.
Could you kind of compare virtual college counseling to the in-person variety? Yeah. And what have you found to be kind of the important distinctions, and how do you address those in your services? Because they're, you know, specifically virtual.
So I think that with virtual, like many things, there's pros and cons. I think you lose a lot of things when you leave that in person behind. Maybe not as much as many people think, but I think one of the things that I find to be truly compelling when working in person is the ability to read another person, like their body language, their tone, their attention, like where is it? I think it's a lot easier, even though we have cameras and Zoom is so prevalent, it's a lot easier to be physically there with a person to get them engaged and keep them engaged and also gauge like, where's their energy levels? Because there's sometimes where you can tell someone's burned out and you're like, hey, we're not making any progress right now. Like, let's take a break, grab coffee, or like, you know, chill or whatever. I think that that sometimes gets lost in the virtual world because a lot of people have transitioned where school or work or professional connections happen through this webcam and that square on my screen. And so they've gotten very good at hiding either, you know, another web browser off to the second screen, or they've gotten good at like keeping their phone at a place where it's like right here beneath the square. So I think that that's one natural kind of downfall of the virtual side is it is certainly harder to monopolize attention when it comes to having these kinds of interactions. The positive side is that, and a lot of parents I think struggle with this, talking about that technology gap, most students feel totally comfortable being on a Zoom call because most students have spent a good portion of their youth now online with friends, playing video games with people, communicating through audio or visual. And then the pandemic also kind of forced that virtual environment too. So most students can hop on and I'll have a conversation with them. And if they can stay, you know, focused in for our meeting, then it's just like talking to them if they're staying across the table from me. I definitely think another benefit of virtual is a lot of the technology helps create structure in the sense that, you know, my students that I work with, they know what their homework is going to be, you know, several months in ahead. They know where to find their homework because it's all on one central profile. It's all linked to their own Google Drive. So it makes it very, very easy for students who are comfortable with utilizing that technology to kind of have everything one click away. Like, you don't have to dig through a backpack. You don't have to worry about leaving something at home. That's one of the reasons that we talk about Google Docs when we work on essays is it's great because I can see a history of edits. if needed, I can see who has been in there. Yeah. You know, all that kind of stuff, and being able to leave comments, and especially nowadays, I can leave a short video comment in a Google Doc. So, like, I don't even have to worry about rambling on in some long comment. If I see something, I can just click record on something. And so I think we use, Loom is the software you use, but it just creates a quick little video, and you can just take that link, shove it into a Google Doc, and it can be like, hey, yeah, like, hey, John, I really like this paragraph, but I've noticed you've used the word, you know, transparency 4 times. So maybe we should think of some different ways to do that. Right. And like, it becomes a lot more digestible.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
Sometimes you get a very, very personal view into a student's life, because a lot of these students are like having Zooms in their room. And sometimes that can be awesome because you can look on their wall and go, hey, man, like, I see that you love movies. Like, I love movies. Like, let's connect. Or alternatively, and we've had to put this in our contract, you have a plethora of people who sign into their meeting from their cell phone in their bed for waking up from a nap without a shirt on. And you're like, whoa, you're like, come on, man. Like, we can't be having this. Right. Time out. And so we've even put in our contract that like students have to be comfortably but appropriately dressed during our meetings. That's something like, you know, most people that you meet, assuming they're not coming from like a soccer practice or something, they come out and they've got their outfit on. They might have done makeup. They might have put some product in their hair. Like, they're socially presentable by their own standard.
Right.
But a lot of times log in and they're like, I'm having a crappy day. My hair's all over the place. Like, I'm wearing my sleep shirt. Right. And that can be sometimes really awesome, because sometimes you can get students to be a little bit more open about their thoughts and their feelings because they feel like they're in a little bit of a safer spot to talk about that. There's some pieces where the virtual will really struggle, and then there's other pieces where sometimes it can open that door. And I think something that I talk with my students about is I'm a huge nerd, and I'm pretty open about it. I used to not be. Like, during high school, I hid it because it was not popular, or I thought it would affect my social, you know, quality of how people perceive me. But like, when I open the Zoom room and I see that a student has like, you know, like a video game model or poster or something, like, I can be like, hey, man, like, I see you've got Dark Souls picture back there. And they'll be like, you know what Dark Souls is? I'll be like, man, I got a tattoo of Dark Souls. Let's connect that way. So sometimes it can give you those brief moments to let them know that they're like, hey, this guy's not just a teacher who's at school. Like, he exists outside of the world.
Here are a couple of things that stuck out to me after the second segment of my conversation with Sawyer. The first thing is when he was talking about the application services that they offer, and he listed through them, you know, oh, we're going to talk about, you know, what's the best course selection, and, you know, how do we figure out what extracurriculars to do, and, you know, how to approach deadlines. And I was thinking in the context of my own daughter and thinking, well, that's a piece of cake. I mean, you know, we can easily help them figure out where the best course to be taking. What should you do with your extracurriculars? How should you be planning? You know, coming up with a list and when to write the essay and how to take the SAT. But then it occurred to me that it's my daughter. Like that. And, you know, if it had been some random person that I hadn't had 20 years of experience with, you know, brush your teeth, get ready for school, like, let's get out the door, like that 20 years of baggage, it would be a piece of cake. But as is, it's impossible. You know, and I think that would just make that whole experience fraught with anxiety and conflict in ways that are utterly unnecessary. On the other hand, I don't want to leave that to her altogether, because she still is fairly young in her development and her prefrontal cortex development, and does need that sort of support in meeting those deadlines and making the right decisions and that sort of thing. So I think that's why it's so critical to have all these support systems, why they all exist for kids in this very critical time and decision-making for their lives. I also found it interesting how he discussed the plus minus, the online setting in working with students. And some of the negatives, I thought, were things that were potentially addressable. I mean,
mean, I think when you're talking about when you can't read people, you know, and I think the point that he made beyond that too, and perhaps is more important, they can't keep their attention. So it's certainly not going to be a format for lecture. I just don't think that you're going to get nearly as much in just presenting a bunch of information to a kid who's in their room surrounded by distractions. However, I think if you're talking about an engaged activity that they are doing and you are guiding them through it, whether that is, all right, you're going to write your essay now, or here, you're going to generate, even if it's just the college essay, you're going to list a bunch of ideas about what you might want to write that essay about. That, I think, is a totally different ball game from, I'm just going to dump out a bunch of information at you and hope some things stick. Even if that is very relevant information to what they're working on, I just don't think that, you know, they can stay plugged in those circumstances. But I've had a lot of success where it's that student, the kid, who's actually doing the activity, and I'm just kind of guiding them through that. I don't think there's really the potential for getting distracted as much when you're actively doing something, and I'm watching that in real time occur. How has the landscape of virtual college counseling evolved in the post-COVID climate? Right. Is it more popular today than it was in 2019? Mm.
So this is always interesting because I technically hopped in to be an independent college counselor straight into virtual. So I never had to experience necessarily as a college counselor like that in-person side. I know there were virtual companies beforehand, and they were not the predominantly popular way that most independent college counselors worked. Mm. When we'd fly independent college counselors in to like visit our school, or if they would be like traveling and stop by for a visit day, a lot of times they were very local, right? If you lived in Boulder, you worked in Boulder, maybe you might go to Denver and all your students were from Boulder and you were meeting at a local coffee shop or a library or something if you didn't have your own office. And I think that certainly the pandemic switched a lot of people to virtual. And a lot of people made that transition pretty seamlessly, where they began to realize that they could have a lot of the benefits of technology without having to, you know, schlep back and forth to an office or a library or a coffee shop. I will definitely say that for me, the reason we have virtual college counselors is as the pandemic began to kind of really take hold in the United States, we'll think like March 2020 when schools were starting to shut down, I was in the process of starting to leave my job at Hendricks College and was thinking about what did I want to do next. And one of the things I immediately thought was, you know, not a lot of people realize it's really easy to buy domains. I should check out and see like what domains are out there right now. And so I started looking into Google Trends and seeing what search options were out there and seeing, you know, what combination of virtual, remote, online, college advising, college counselors, what were all of those different combinations looking like? And that's truthfully why we ended up with virtual college counselors is it has a decent ring to it, but really it was because that combination of words was statistically on the rise because of COVID. And so that kind of became the domain that we stuck with because it just was the most common phraseology that most people were using.
Are there trends that you're noticing that students and parents should be aware of in terms of virtual experience?
So one thing I would highly recommend to all parents and students is one of the dangers about independent college counseling, and I hate to even phrase it that way because it can be misused. There's plenty of good things happening. But one of the frustrations I think a lot of people feel is that this is definitely a field where you can hang a shingle or put up a website and have zero qualifications and charge oodles of money. And most people don't care and don't know how to validate that. One of the reasons that I joined IECA is because at the time it was considered a way to kind of be a mark of a professional. Right. What I realized is as we worked with families, nobody asked us about our credentials. Very few people asked us about testimonials or previous clients. A lot of people just were referred to us and they just took it. And that was totally fine. But one of the reasons I stay with IECA, and this will tie back into this question, is because I believe, and this is something that I'll rarely say, I believe there should be more regulation and oversight in my field. And I hate to say that because we have, you know, every 6 months you have some article about, you know, an IEC that is charging, you know, $750,000, or they are guaranteeing Ivy League admissions, or you have the Rick Singer kind of Varsity Blues scenario with all the scandal involved in that.
Right,
and so one of the reasons why I continue to be an IECA, even if I could find resources like it elsewhere, is because that's kind of the horse I'm betting on to be the governing agency when eventually enough people and enough donors or enough people with money and influence are burned that they start to reach out to politicians to make change. People will make up fake testimonials. I mean, it can be really difficult. Yeah. And so, I mean, one of the reasons that's why I'm an ICA, that's why I'm a certified educational planner. And I went through the whole like process of that is because these are the things that I see in the future being those hallmarks of being able to avoid some of that regulation or being able to legitimize the business. If I had to say, when we're thinking about virtual college counseling, the two biggest things, one, make sure the person you're working with has something that gives them credentials. Ideally, it might be professional membership at an organization where they're bound by ethics, might be, you know, experience. Yeah. Like, I'm not a gatekeeper. If you want to like start up your own business and you want to put in the work and effort to like build up a professional profile and it's not through a traditional path, totally fine. But just make sure there's something.
Yeah.
And the only other thing I would add there is that in-person meetings, a lot of times can force students to do things. Virtually, I cannot force your student to do much. You have to really make sure that your student is buying into this opportunity, because otherwise what's going to end up happening is you're going to hire me to help them through this process and to kind of be that mediator between student and parent. And then the student, if they're not in the right mindset, will reject me. And then I'm going to have to ask you to get them to do things. Because I cannot, because I am not in their room, I'm not in their house, I'm not in a classroom with them. And so that's the other thing I think a lot of people will not, they haven't quite made that connection yet, that just because they are meeting virtually with me doesn't mean I can force them, or and sometimes I can sit down with them and share screen and go, hey, write your essay. And like, we're going to do it together because you've done this where I can't trust you to do it on your own. But that's, I think, the other big thing that we run into a lot with virtual stuff.
Here are some final thoughts that I have after my conversation with Sawyer. It was interesting to hear him talk about the role of the Independent Educational Consultants Association, the IECA, as it is kind of the organization that marks educational consultants as reasonable or amateur. There were two things that he said about the IECA. One was they were having less conferences, or at least those conferences were really kind of gradually diminishing in their value, which I find to be the case, because you have so many other online platforms for networking, really is what it is, and exchanging information about best practices and supporting clients, but you have less of a need there with social media and YouTube and webinars, you know, online courses, all the billions of resources that are out there. So you are seeing a waning in large organizations like that, which would be able to offer the certification. And as he mentioned, that he thought there would be more and more of a need for as we go into the future. And he mentioned, well, people getting burned, high-level people getting burned by amateur educational consultants presenting themselves as those who are more knowledgeable. Well, there's a real tension there. When you have higher demand for an organization, it's also waning in its own existence. There's going to be a real void when it comes to choosing quality individuals. And I think you sort of see that in real time. Sometimes people find their way through a friend of a friend, through a service that's been recommended to them. But I think it's a very sloppy process compared to what it could be if we were able to wield the resources that we have in this modern technological world in finding the best resources for educational consultants and for basically any service you can imagine too. Another thing that stuck out to me was really the last bit when Sawyer was talking about the sensationalism of college applications. And because of social media and because of the sharing of experience and that has become copious in our lives, the only story you see is the kid who's got a 4.7 GPA, as you said, has a startup, tri-varsity athlete, and wrote no on the college application, one word response on the essay, and is going to Yale. Fantastic. But, you know, what about the whole middle class to throw a term onto it. And that's a very intentional economic term, by the way, as well as a figurative one. But what about that middle class? Where does that go when you've entered an age of sensationalism where the only things that are visible are those really bad or really good? When it comes to college application, that middle class is really suffering. You know, you've got the Yales and Harvards and the et cetera of the world with application numbers that are escalating seemingly into infinity and admission rates that are dropping into nothing. And then you've got the other schools that are going out of business because they can't get people in the doors. And then you have this whole huge amorphous in between. And that, I think, is the blank space that still needs to be filled in, that a lot of the next generation of education professionals are going to have to sort through that middle area and find what is it that's good quality, what is it that's bad quality, what is the good fit, what's not a good fit, and then how to present that in a way that makes sense to people, that doesn't have to be sensationalized, that doesn't have to be extreme, like way out there, man, like, yeah. Like, it's not clickbait, but it's actually good quality, legitimate information. I think people are going to find a value for that once the glow, the glitz and glamour of the technological age wears off a bit. And then what are we left with? We still have all the same needs and they still have to be filled. And one of the biggest ones is, what's going to happen to our kids?